Now, to my studio guest, and if you're a fan of his work, as I'm sure many of you are, you're in for a bit of a treat. The Derry, and acclaimed Derry crime author Brian McGilloway is publishing a new book. I've just been handed it. It's called Preserve the Dead. It's the third tome to feature Detective Superintendent Lucy Black. And of course, the man himself is Brian McGilloway. Good to see you.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us.
Brian, so much to talk about today. When you cooked up your sleuths of various natures and disguises, do you ever think you would get to the stage where you were pushing, what, 750,000 units?
No, I didn't. And in fact, with the first one, I wrote the first book purely selfishly. I wrote it for myself. Because I was and remain a crime reader before a crime writer. And when I wrote Borderlands, a lot of the series that I read, the detectives were all dying off or were retiring. And I kind of wanted to write a book that I would want to read. So it was really as selfish as that. I probably shouldn't say that, but
after the like of Rebus, that kind of stuff.
I mean, I was my biggest kind of hero in terms of crime writing is an American writer called James Lee Burke. Mm-hmm. And he had a book called Last Car to Elysian Fields. And at the time that it came out, Morse had died, and Rebus was retiring. And in Last Car to Elysian Fields, Dave Robichaux, the hero, was out jogging in the park in New Orleans at dawn and thinks he's taking a heart attack, and he kind of stops at a park bench and thinks, is this it? Is this after surviving mafia hits and, well, all kinds of adventures, is this how it's going to end? And I remember being quite sad by that, because I think particularly with crime, because it's a series and because you kind of, I mean, James Lee Burke, I think, is about 23 or 24 books, and each year you kind of reacquaint yourself with that character. And then when the characters die off, it is... there is a kind of a part of you that feels sorry to have lost that kind of connection that
you had.
But
it's the same with box
character.
Sets. When they finish, you're going, please make more.
Make
please
some more of it, yeah. And yet at the same time, you kind of don't want to destroy the legacy of what was there too. Mm. So I wrote Borderlands kind of purely as, right, well, of all these characters that I liked, I want to write a character that I would want to read about. Mm-hmm. And then when I finished it, I didn't write it to be published. I wrote it just for me to read.
Well, which beats me to my next question. Starting out, tremendous confidence and spirit to say, you know what, I'm going to call myself an author. I'm going to write books and maybe get something published. Did you care at the start, Brian, that a dozen or two dozen people would buy the darn things?
No, I didn't even think it would be made. Or I didn't think it would be published. I didn't think it would get that far. And in a way, you kind of have to be your own biggest fan and your own biggest critic at the same time, because there's a huge amount of arrogance involved in writing a book.
Really?
Well, there has to be, because what you're kind of saying is, here, I have something to say about the world and I think other people will be interested in what I have to say.
But it's not you saying it, it's her saying it.
But it's not, well, yeah, but you're kind of writing about issues that concern you, but at the same time as there being a huge amount of arrogance, there's also a huge amount of kind of insecurity in it as well, because you're kind of putting it out there and really leaving it open that people can say whatever they want. Mm. And you have to take it. You have to accept the fact that it's a book and some people will like it and some people won't, and you kind of have to take... You have to take the applause and the catcalls in equal measure.
Well, yes, and I'm sure you've had both. Well, somebody, what happens if you read the Washington Post and the boys saying this guy McGilloway couldn't write crime for peanuts?
Well,
I'm sure you've had that stuff, have you?
Well, I mean, with the first book, whenever I first tried, it took me about 3 or 4 years to find a publisher, and the book opened with a dead body lying on the border and two police officers, one guard and one PSNI officer, standing over the body talking about it. And I sent it to a publisher who replied back saying, "Sorry, we're not interested. We only publish crime novels." So, I mean, even in that, there's kind of, even when you think it's very obviously crime, not everybody would necessarily agree.
And when you're on a winner like Devlin, I mean, what your first sleuth,
yes,
when you're on a winner like Devlin, why suspend that at the height of his powers almost and change your attention totally, gender and everything, and then Lucy Black emerges? Whence her creation?
There's a couple of different things. I had always wanted to write something set in the North. And whenever I first started writing, things were still very, very raw, and this kind of political situation and social situation was changing a lot. And part of the difficulty with books, I mean, this book is coming out now at the start of August. I wrote it a year and a half ago, nearly 2 years ago. And so by the time the book actually comes out, it's anachronistic. And it's quite difficult to write something then during a very volatile and unbalanced social situation, because there's every possibility that it's going to have changed.
But isn't the trick there to keep your themes generic then, that they won't date?
But then for crime fiction especially, crime fiction is very much a reflection of the place it comes from. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I love about it. It's very much part of its own geographical place. And really what happened just with Devlin, I was enjoying writing them, and then I just I kind of got to a point where the next story that I had didn't suit him. I wanted to write a story about a child being found in the woods.
Little girl lost.
And somebody had told me that when children have suffered a certain form of trauma, when they suffer trauma and they're not prepared to talk about it, one way that psychiatrists or psychologists will use to try to get to connect with them is to read fairy tales. And the fairy tale that the child identifies with will reflect on the trauma that they have suffered, because fairy tales are just about our innate fears. I mean, they're about kind of separation anxiety and kind of fear of the world and liminality and so on. And my idea was, right, this child will be found in the woods, the police officer will sit in the hospital visiting her at night because nobody has claimed her, and we'll read fairy tales and she'll react to one of the fairy tales.
It's still one of the abiding images I have of books I've read those last 10 years. There she is. She stood in Prehen Wood.
Yes.
It's a winter scene. Yeah. And every reader will have a different memory of that. The minute that book opens, you're going, my God.
Well, it's a fairy tale. I mean, it is. A child in the woods is a fairy tale. That's the bog standard stereotype of fairy tales, and it is a fairy tale in itself. But the problem that I had with Devlin was Devlin would never be sitting in the hospital with somebody else's child reading them stories at night.
Such were his sensitivities.
Well, even just because he had his own family.
Yeah.
And because if it was a young child, it would be a female officer. And after having three sons, we had our first daughter. And I kind of wanted to write a book for her as well. So that was kind of where Lucy came from. And I had planned it to be a one-off. And then when I finished it, I kind of realised that she had more stories to tell.
Bran, with your permission, I mean, I've just been handed it. I can't wait.
Right.
But with your permission, can I just give a little, just the opening paragraph?
That's okay.
Opening two sentences.
If you want, yeah, of course.
The bruising extended from his temple around the curve of the eye socket and down almost to where the fold of his laughter line curled to meet his lip. So that opens the curtain, Bran, in broad terms, to what?
I was trying to work out what I could say about it without giving too much away. The book opens with Lucy visiting her father in the hospital. Her father's in a secure unit down at the bridge, and an orderly comes in and says that a body has been spotted in the water. And she and several of the staff go out and they manage to recover this body from the water, and they assume initially that it's either someone who has fallen in or has jumped in. And then when one of the doctors examines the body, they discovered the body has already been embalmed.
There you go. And from the sleeve notes, which you'll not mind, I'm sure, on a human evening, County Derry, there's a secure unit in Grantia Hospital, banks of the River Foyle. And this is I love it, because this is going to be in airports all over the world and booksellers all over the world. It must feel fantastic.
It's strange. I mean, it's lovely, because you write a book and you want people to read it, and that's it. I mean, it's kind of... But it's a bit... Yeah.
Do you ever travel through Barcelona and see one of your books?
I have. We were in Italy last year, actually, and we went and we kind of found a copy of Borderlands, one of the Italian copies of Borderlands in a bookshop, which was quite nice. I've only ever actually seen... I was in London about 2 years ago, and I was kind of walking through one of the train stations, and I saw somebody sitting in a cafe reading one of the books.
Amazing.
Which was surreal, actually. I think that was the strangest experience.
And in the modern world, Bran, of you know, social media and stuff, I mean, your P.T. Woodhouses would have sat and had correspondence, you know, maybe with a dozen people or whatever. But in the modern world, does the McGillivray thing have a fan base? Does that all develop alongside the printed work?
I don't know. I mean, it is the height of arrogance to get to say I've got a fan base. I mean, certainly people will contact
you. But clearly
I have. Well, people will contact you. I mean, I think reading is such a personal thing. And it is. It's lovely that people, if they have been significantly moved by the book or have enjoyed it, that they will kind of try to find you out and contact you. In some good ways and in some bad ways. And whenever I was teaching... people used to send me letters to the school. Again, some very positive and some very negative. One person wrote to me every single year, and I'll not say where this person was from, but I get a letter from her every year having counted the number of swear words that were in the book.
Yes.
And saying what a shocking role model I was for young people that I was running. But every year she still bought the book.
Of course, yeah. So. Yeah, I hate you, but I love your work. Bran, what's it like, though? Because as a teacher, you know the line that you walk as an educator. But suddenly, as a writer, you have permission to delve deeply into the human condition. Is there a freedom in that releases you as a human being?
Well, I mean, they are two different things. They're two completely different careers. And I suppose one of the things that I loved about writing was that teaching was and is such a social job, and you're so kind of out there and you've got so many people kind of chatting around and you're talking all the time. And then whenever it comes to writing, you're completely on your own. And you have nobody talking at you, and you're kind of just in your old world. And that's kind of a lovely thing to do. And kind of one of the things I suppose that I found was whenever I started writing, I think I probably became a better teacher from it. Because it's one thing kind of teaching English, but I think then whenever you're kind of having to put it into practice, it's a much better way to reinforce the skills, and you get a greater sense of the skills.
Not trying to get your windows broke, but do you talk to the police? Do you talk to surgeons?
I do. I mean, you have to research everything. And quite often people will contact you and offer expertise, which is lovely. And even the other night I did an event in Letterkenny, and at the end of it, two retired guards come up and said, oh, what do you tell you? And people tell you stories. People love telling stories. And they will come along and they'll give you a kind of a snippet of a story, and you might find you'll use it or you'll kind of allude to it at some point.
But do you need to be cautious? Because maybe 2 years down the line, a loved one comes up and says, Brant, that scene you described in the mortuary, that was my dad. I know it was my dad because it was what I saw in the mortuary.
Yeah, I mean, I think the difficulty with that, and you don't use personal stuff. I mean, people generally will tell you funny stuff. They'll kind of come and tell you a kind of funny anecdote about what do you hear? This happened to the friend of a friend of a friend, and there's enough of a remove. I think the difficulty, especially with the first books, I think people assume that you are your main character and that every other character is somebody you know. And certainly with the first, my wife, a couple of times people would have said to her, oh, that's based on this or that's based on that.
And Derry's a small town.
And it wasn't at all. There was none of that. But people will kind of assume that because you have written the book and they know you, then the book is about your world.
I wonder at what stage in this journey you give yourself permission to self-define as an author.
I think you do from the start. I mean, I think from the very beginning, you kind of have to say, right, this is what I'm doing and this is my job and I'm going to take it seriously. I mean, in a way, you either are a writer or you're not. It's compulsion, as far as I'm concerned. It's something that I can't not do.
But you don't think it's something that people hide under the pillow for years and then say, oh, darn, I must have a go?
I think sometimes. I mean, one of the things, and I find this kind of challenging, quite often people will say to you, and they mean it with the best will in the world, but quite often people will say to you, if I had time, I would write a book. That kind of suggests that I have loads of time on my hands. And when people were saying this, I was teaching full time. We had four kids under the age of seven. It wasn't like I had loads of spare time. It's just something that you have to do, and you have to do it every single day.
Well, I ask because I understand you've taken a remarkable decision. I mean, I'm assuming there's a few bob coming in when you sell 750,000 books, but you're going back to the.
I'll go back into teaching.
You're going back to teaching.
I am. I took a career break a couple of years ago.
To write 1 hour a day.
Well, see, this was the problem because part of my difficulty was I had, by the time I took the career break, I think I'd written six or seven books and had kind of trained myself into writing an hour and a half a day and doing about 1,000 words a day and had kind of built that had kind of trained, quite literally had trained myself into that pace and kind of found that once I'd done my chapter or the 1,000 words, that was me, I was happy. And then whenever I took the break, I realised that I was still really only doing 1,000 words a day. And even though I have a lot more writing to do because I'm kind of working on a couple of different projects now beyond the books, but I still find that I really only was doing about an hour and a half a day.
Isn't that what Stephen King said every writer should do? No matter if you feel like it or don't, it should be 1,000 words a day,
every
no matter.
Day, yeah. And you have to do it. You have to do it every day. And the idea of kind of doing a couple of days and then taking a week and a half or a fortnight's break, you can't do that because what happens is you lose momentum. But also you forget what you've written and then you have to go back and reread it. And as soon as you reread it, you see all the mistakes and then you start rewriting it. And then you spend another week repolishing the opening of the story rather than just moving it forward.
Yes.
And the trick is actually just you write the entire thing from start to finish. It doesn't matter if it's good, bad or indifferent because you're going to rewrite it 6 or 7 times before it ever sees the light of day anyway. And at least if you have done it the first time and you kind of get that 2 or 3 months, because really it's 1,000 words a day and average novel's about 80,000-90,000 words. So you're looking at about 3 months. And that's it. It's a first draft. It's very rough. You're not going to show it to anybody, but at least the story is there and it's out of your head and you have a kind of a shape to it. And then you can come back and you can start moving stuff around and polishing it up and redrafting and cutting out the stuff that doesn't work and maybe building on stuff that you wanted to develop. And of course the ending or the opening will change completely because how you think the book's going to go, it never does. It
Do you know the end as you start?
Rarely.
Right.
Rarely. You might know the ending for a single character. And I think that I kind of need that. I would get bored. If I knew how it was going to end, there'd be no point in me writing the story.
Well, talking about boredom, did you miss the teaching or what?
Well, I think that was the big thing, yeah. I mean, I was going to say, I was doing kind of an hour and a half a day, and the thing that I missed most, I really missed the kids. I have to say, I missed being in the classroom, and I missed chatting about books, and I missed the crack that I had with the kids. And that was really it. I kind of thought, no, I'm glad I've done it. And had I never done it, I would have spent my time going, oh, I really wish I'd do this full time. And I tried it out, and really, yeah, I missed.
But I'm not trying to stick my nose in here doing the journalistic thing, but I'm assuming, quote, you don't have to work again, do you?
I have four children. Always have to work. And, you know, it's not a financial thing at all. It is, and this kind of sounds strange, but I think with teaching or with any kind of vocational job, there is a real sense that you are making a difference and you're doing something valuable. Mm. And I had that much, much more with teaching than I think I had with writing, because with writing, you don't see it. You write a book and it goes out there and somebody might be reading it in America or Canada or wherever, but you don't see that.
And yet so many writers become these detached, esoteric, mysterious figures. You want to get back into the grist of life.
Well, you see, the other thing is, of course, I mean, there are only so many stories that you can tell, and you have to be aware of kind of what's going on in the world around you. And I kind of wonder, I mean, if somebody like J.D. Salinger locked himself away, I can understand why he never really did anything beyond Catcher in the Rye, because if your entire world experience is limited to your immediate surroundings and nothing else, then that's going to make it very difficult.
But
to
keep how awful
stories.
For Salinger and writers like him to be cocooned in your single masterpiece. I know he wrote Franny and Zooey and stuff after that, but like nothing up to.
But I think with Salinger it was a choice. I mean, I think Salinger just was, I think he found publication to be so unpleasant.
But your instinct is the opposite, to find yourself enmeshed in life all over again and refreshed for it.
Yeah, and also just because it's enjoyable. You know, I enjoy teaching, and it sounds kind of strange to say, and I get fulfillment from teaching, and the youngsters just bring such a different kind of aspect to your life, and they make you feel like you're making a difference. Mm-hmm. And it's lovely to meet kids kind of 10, 15 years after you've taught them, because I had been teaching for about 18 years when I took a break, and you meet people that you taught, and they do keep in contact. In the same way that readers do, you'll have past students who'll get in contact.
I'm assuming students know you're writing at this level.
I don't know. I mean, I didn't talk about it because
when I started Queen's, Seamus Heaney was, I think it was Seamus, was teaching, and I was like, you know, the poet fella, he's teaching around the corner there where we're studying. And it didn't really seep in until the latter greatness of Seamus. And I'm sure you wouldn't be putting yourself in the same tomes as Seamus, but who knows down the years, you know, that here you are at your teaching stage in life. You know,
I mean, I suppose the difficulty for me is that because of the type of thing I'm writing, I mean, I write crime, and it is very obviously it's an adult genre. So I tended not to talk about it with the kids. I mean, if they asked, I was quite happy to answer questions in terms of if they were interested in writing themselves. Mm-hmm. You would kind of give advice about, well, you should maybe do this or try this. And if they brought me something in to read, I would read it and I would give them advice on it. But in terms of actually talking about the content of the books, that just wasn't, I didn't feel it appropriate.
You and I have spoken a couple of times, Brian, and I always appreciate you coming in. It's brilliant. And I just think it's so fantastic that we have a writer of your caliber on the doorstep and, you know, just going up and up and up and up in the world. New York Times bestseller, for goodness sake. And we've talked before about telly, because I've suggested to you that you're a visual writer. You're that image of Little Girl Lost, the wee girl in Prehen Forest, it totally lends itself to a visual narrative, dare I say, to those expensive TV series, dare I say, to Hollywood. Anything else to report on that, or any interest?
There's always interest. I think that's whether anything happens or not a bit different thing. But the Devlin is, we're kind of waiting a decision on Devlin.
Are there 100 writers like you? Waiting on decisions. Are you well advanced?
Well, I mean, it's well enough advanced. It's the script is written and it kind of has moved through certain levels already, and I think there's one more level for it just to go through.
UK or the States?
UK.
Right. BBC? We can't really say. Series, Brian, or film?
A series. I think they were doing it as a three-parter. So that was Borderlands. Now, that is if it gets made.
Waking the Dead kind of thing?
I think the writer who has done the script is a very, very, very good writer, and she writes a lot for...
She writes your script?
We say, you don't write your own script. No, I mean, and certainly for that one, I was kind of happy enough not to, because at that stage I hadn't written any screenplays, and I have kind of worked on stuff since, but when the book was optioned, I liked the idea of having somebody else coming in who knew the language of screenwriting much better than I did and would do a much better job.
You see the Game of Thrones thing bringing a claim here, and The Fall bringing a claim here, especially with The Fall thing being the crime and that. Does it give you a feel that we have something to offer here? Because, you know, 20, maybe 30 years ago, you had Jennifer Johnson writing from here, you know, albeit with the Dublin influence and her work and all the rest. Do you get a feeling of changing ground under your feet in terms of that whole neck?
I think
of it?
There is, aye. And I mean, I think we're due a really good Northern Ireland-based show. And I say that aware of all else it's made. I mean, Game of Thrones is fantastic, but it's not based in Northern Ireland.
They're filming
in
McGilligan, as we speak.
Ireland.
They're filming
in
McGilligan.
Yeah. It's made here, but it's not a Northern Ireland show as such. Call of Duty, likewise. And even The Fall, arguably, although it is very much Northern Ireland-based, it's not really about Northern Ireland.
Yes.
So I think we are due a show, and certainly there have, I mean, the year that I started writing, there were 7 new crime novels by Irish writers come out. This year alone, I think there's been 33 or 34. So there has been this kind of explosion in the publishing of writing from here, of crime writing from here. So I think it's only a matter of time, actually, before because even RTE, of course, had Love Hate. So I think Northern Ireland is due. Is due its version, or due some kind?
I know it's not out yet. Can I read this if I promise not to talk about it?
Yeah, of course. I was going to actually say, if you wanted to give it away, you could, just as a...
No,
okay.
No, we're not giving this away. This is mine.
I only have one copy, but otherwise we'd have brought out a couple. You're more than welcome to it.
Well, when are you launching?
I don't know if I'm going to do a launch yet. It's out on the 6th of August. I mean, the whole thing, it's because it's the middle of the summer and I'm kind of aware of the fact that there's people away. What I might do is maybe do some kind of an event in September. I must have a chat with the library, who have always been great supporters of the books. But it's out 6th of August. So I don't know. It'll be sometime thereafter.
On your publisher's littlebrown.co.uk.
Yes.
Little Brown, thecrimevault.com. Brand is fantastic, and I think a lot of listeners
thanks
are out there sort of whooping and hollering that you're doing this at such a prestigious level, and every success with it. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
The Derry author, Brian McGilloway, he's gone back to teaching, but he's still writing hard. The Daily Telegraph comments on his work with regard to Detective Superintendent Black, Lucy Black. It's a nimbly written, cleverly plotted tale. Give Black a try. It could be the start of a beautiful friendship. And the, as I say, we're talking here about a New York Times best-selling crime author here on the doorstep. It's great.